This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Lieutenant Colonel Ray Janes on the 7th of March 2003 at approximately 9:30. We are in the Special Collections Library interview room at Texas Tech University. Well, first, thanks for coming and consenting to this interview. Why don't we begin by discussing your early life, and if you would, tell me when and where you were born, where you grew up.
Okay, I was born in Dallas, Texas, and lived there until I went away to college and high school. And in college, I was one of the first 50 cadets to enroll in ROTC in 1949, because I was concerned that if we ever got into another war, I had known from Army ROTC in high school that I wanted to go in the Air Force and I wanted to be an officer.
Okay.
And so I enrolled in it, and then, of course, Korea happened the next year, and we had 800 cadets in the fall of 1950.
Wow.
So that shows you a lot of guys were all of a sudden woke up.
Yes, sir. How many were there when you first enrolled in ROTC, in Air Force
50.
ROTC? Just 50.
Just 50,
okay. Now, were you drawn to the Air Force ROTC program? Well, what university, first of all?
It was...
Or college.
You want the today's name, or...
Whichever.
Okay. Well,
what it was then, and then we'll...
It was East Texas State Teachers College back then.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to be a school teacher.
Okay.
Because I couldn't think of anything else to do. And it's now known as Texas A&M Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
It's went through several name changes, and probably it'll have some more before it's over.
Yes, sir. Well, when you were growing up in Dallas, what was that like? I mean, you grew up during the, assume you remember some of the Great Depression, maybe the very tail end of the Great Depression, and then the Second World War. So what do you remember about those major events?
Well, I was lucky in as far as the Great Depression was. My dad had a good job.
Okay.
He was paid $50 a week, which was an enormous amount back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically enough, when the war came along, his pay was frozen and everybody else was making a lot of money and we were getting poorer. So I grew up in a small community in Dallas County called Urbandale at the time, and I went to a county school through the eighth grade. And then we were taken into the city of Dallas because we got tired of doing without water in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got connected to Dallas Water. And I went to Woodrow Wilson High School, which was an excellent high school in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And went from there to college. And, I took Army ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And what convinced me that I wanted to be in the Air Force was that we had three old master sergeants who showed us films of the battles that they participated in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And told us about what it was really like, and you could see the tears welling up in their eyes. And I said, I don't think I want to live like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, ironically, I was attached to the Army. And
and live like that.
Yeah, well, not quite. It was not as bad as it could be.
Yes, sir. Did you have any relatives that served
in
the Second World War?
Yes, I had relatives. I had one who was a Marine who made three landings in the Pacific and was discharged because of post-traumatic stress syndrome, what was called shell shock or combat fatigue or whatever you want to call it back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And I had another uncle who was a major, and he was a railroad expert, so he's the one who rebuilt the railroads in Germany
mm-hmm.
after World War II.
Wow.
They offered him a regular commission to stay, and he turned it down. And so, anyway, I also had another uncle who was in the Air Force, in the Army, but stationed at Hondo. But he had a bad heart, and they found it and released him before he was always bitter about that, because he said, I could have done work in the country and filled a slot for some guy who could go to combat, but they wouldn't do it. So. Anyway, I had some relatives who were in the war, and in fact, there were in our high school. It was de rigueur for everybody to be in ROTC. We had 800 students in the high school. We had about 400 of them were boys, And all out of those, everybody was in ROTC except 25 who took PE. Even the band members were all ROTC. We had an ROTC band.
Mm-hmm.
And they wore the uniform and marched in it and everything. They didn't have the fancy uniforms. They did have some uniforms, but most of the time they marched in the ROTC uniforms. And so it was still very patriotic back in those days. And so most of us felt some guilt about not being old enough. If it had gone on a couple more years, I would have been old enough. Of course, my mother was extremely frightened about that, and even my dad got worried. He was 33,
mm-hmm.
and they were beginning to draft 33-year-olds, and the only thing that kept him out was the fact that he had an important job in the trucking industry,
okay.
which was considered vital,
mm-hmm.
and he was married and had kids. But they would eventually have gotten to him if it had gone on much longer.
What did your dad do in the trucking industry?
Okay, he was a bookkeeper.
Okay.
He also worked in the movie industry before that. I got to see free movies beginning when I was about 3 years old.
Did you?
They had what they call the screening process in downtown Dallas where they censored the movies.
Yes.
And decided what they were going to show and not. And we got to go in there, down there anytime we wanted to. They showed movies every evening to that censoring board. And since he worked for the company, and at any time movies they were considering showing were shown, we could go free.
Oh, that's funny.
And, they built the Texas Theater,
mm-hmm.
which I attended, which of course is infamous because of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there in a clothing store just before I went into service, just down from there. And when I had a split shift, I'd go to the movie and, down there. And, so I went to that movie all my life, that wow. theater all my life. And that's in Oak Cliff in Dallas.
Now, do you remember any specific movies that they censored that you got to saw you
no.
got to see them and then but
no.
then they decided not to let
the only one I remember see. Was San Francisco, mm-hmm. where Clark Gable was there during the earthquake and I thought it was spectacular, the walls all collapsing on.
Okay.
Special effects grabs everybody.
Right. But they let that one play to the general public in Dallas. They didn't censor it.
I don't remember any others.
Okay.
That I watch free.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that's probably the only reason that grabbed me is
right.
I had a destructive bent even then, and also had a very literal bent. My dad bought me an electric train, and it just ran in circles, you know, like trains do.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, trains don't run in circles, they run straight. So I took mine out on the sidewalk and ran it on the sidewalk. And it would not run on the tracks after that. And that's the last electric train I ever got.
Wow. Your mom was a homemaker? Your mother was a homemaker?
Yes.
Okay. What else did you do growing up for recreation? You mentioned going to the
movies.
Oh,
we had a lot of open fields and woods around our little development.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a lot of hiking and camping and that sort of stuff. Boy Scouts was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a rather unique thing. We had a military parkway ran straight through our development and divided it equally between the north side and the south side.
Mm-hmm.
So we refought the Civil War and every sport there was. And football, basketball, and baseball. And even rubber guns. Those were wooden guns that you would saw out of a piece of wood and put notches in it. And you'd take an old inner tube and cut it in a circle and tie a knot in the center to make it hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Then you could hook it over the front, break it back, and put it in a clothespin and run around and shoot at each other with them. And we fought World War II that way.
Okay.
We had an old sandbox. And I nailed cardboard on the side of it and put boards across the top of it and took an old bushel basket and made a gun turret. And we flew missions over Germany in that,
uh-huh.
in that old sandbox.
Oh, that's funny.
And we also dug a hole in the garden, and that was our foxhole in Iwo Jima.
Mm-hmm.
And
So you all followed the war pretty closely as kids.
Oh, yeah, we followed the war real close. That's all it was. The front page was filled with war news. Naturally, we didn't really get a lot out of it because it was so censored and so forth. It was a lot. We participated in the scrap drives. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, the Boy Scouts picked up paper every month and picked up a truckload of paper in the neighborhood every month. And all of us coveted certain houses because that's where you got all the comic books. And mm-hmm. you could take them home and read them and then donate them the next time.
Oh, that's funny. Okay.
Comics books were very big, mm-hmm. just like all competition. We had competition throwing tops where you knock bottle caps out of a circle, marbles, mumble peg where you flip the knife, got it to stick in the ground. Everything was very, very competitive all the way through. And also very historical. We put on a historical pageant on Texas history that was so good that we were asked to put it on for the Dallas Historical Society and then asked to put it on during the state fair as well. So we did. I was Stephen F. Austin, and my best friend was Santa Ana.
Oh, wow. Okay. Was this something that you received a lot of reinforcement at home as far as your education, your schooling, the activities that you engaged in?
Yeah, I really did. The thing that really solidified it was that started working when I was 14 years old. Mm-hmm. I worked 6 days a week, carrying 52-pound Royal Crown Cola cases, one in each hand, and to save getting the dolly down if you didn't need it. If you had more of that, you used the dolly. But the dolly was hard to use because it had paved things then, so you had a rut, or you'd have soft drink bottles busted all over the place. Anyway, I got paid $19.56 a week after taxes were deducted. And anyway, I worked hard and I had job after job after job. And I eventually got one with the Coca-Cola company. Mm-hmm. And the guy I worked with on the truck said that he really liked me. And he offered to get me a job as a truck driver, $65 a week, which was, you know, a fortune to me. And so I went home all enthusiastic about dumping college and doing that. And my dad, he says, well, no, you and I need to have a serious talk. He says, $65 a week is a great salary. He says, you know, he says, that's almost as much as I make after all these years. So you'd be doing very well. But I want to give you one caution, and it's the same one that I have experienced. You will never make more than $65 a week. No matter how many raises you get, you'll always be making that same amount. And then when the babies come along, and the wife comes along, and the house comes along, and the car payments come along, he says, then you'll struggle just like I've had to do. If you want to go to college, you go. I'll pay for it somewhere. And so that changed my mind again when I went off to college. Anyway, as it turned out, I wound up paying most of my own anyway because I had, over all those years I had worked, I had saved $800. And when I graduated from college, I was going to buy a car. Well, my dad had renovated the house, which you needed it very badly by that time. And there was a brand new refrigerator and stove in the kitchen. And I went to my savings account and there was no money in it. He said, I ran out of money and I had to use that to buy your mother the stove and refrigerator. And he says, I didn't think you'd mind, but I was afraid to ask you. And I said, well, I wish you'd asked because I'd have given it to you. And so he says, well, you just live here until you go on active duty and won't cost you a penny, and you just save all your money and buy your car. And that's exactly what I did.
Okay. So
my first car was a 1953 used Ford Custom Liner, painted Air Force blue, mm-hmm. and I owned it. I paid it off in 18 months, $50 a month. Mm-hmm. And when I made the grand total of $192 a month after taxes as a second lieutenant. So you can say that $50 a month was a big chunk. Mm-hmm. I learned my lesson right then about car payments. Mm-hmm. But it didn't cost a whole lot to live back in those days.
Yeah. What did you major in college?
I majored in speech. I was a debater in high school, and I had a gift of gab. And so I majored in that, and from that I determined that I wasn't going to be an actor. I wasn't going to be a personality. Mm-hmm. And I was a very good salesman. I sold ladies' shoes my last year in college. If you can sell ladies' shoes, you can sell anything. And then after college, I sold men's clothing. And so I was an excellent salesman. In fact, my last 2 months as a salesman, I made $500, $700 commission in December and $500 in January, and went on active duty the 1st of February. And back in those days, that was a lot of money. And that was a, you had to sell a lot of stuff to do that. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I didn't want to be a salesman because he was up and down. Mm-hmm. That was the top I ever made in the job in the 7 months I worked there. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I was going to be a speech teacher and get out after 2 years. Mm-hmm. Then I wised up later on, which we can get into that if you want to.
Oh, absolutely. Well, just out of curiosity, while you were in high school, did you play sports for the school
teams?
Yes,
I played football, and we won the city championship my senior year.
Okay.
In fact, we just had a 50-year reunion not long ago.
Okay.
Got a lot of the team members back together. And mm-hmm. A lot of fat old men sat around telling lies.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great team. Bill Forrester was our running back, and he became a middle linebacker for the Green Bay Packers into the Lombardi years. He played 2 years for Lombardi, but his career was over by that time. In other words, he was at the end of his career when Lombardi took over. We also had a couple of guys, several guys who played in the Canadian Football League. So we had some very, very good players. Bill was All-American for SMU. He played fullback for us and defensive tackle for SMU, and then he was too small for that in the pros, so he played middle linebacker and called all the defensive plays for the Packers. So he was really a super athlete.
Did you carry that football into college?
No. I did it. I went out for football as a walk-on, and they were doing kickoff drills, and the coach commented at the end of the day, he says, "Well, we better quit before camp kills himself or somebody else." And I said right then, maybe I wasn't big enough to play that game. So I dropped out. And I was an actor in college and a debater and all that kind of stuff. And, took education to be a school teacher.
Okay. What subjects did you enjoy in high school?
Well, obviously I enjoyed debate and speech and some of my English classes. I had mean old Mrs. Miles. Nobody took Ms. Miles under pain of tremendous loads of work. And I wanted to take speech, so I made sure I went there first. And by the time I did that, got in that class, it was too late. I had to take Ms. Miles. And her first words were, says, "You will go down to the Cokesbury bookstore and buy this book, Wariner's Grammar." Buy a textbook in public school? You know, flabbergasted. Mm-hmm. She said, "You will not be able to pass unless you do that, because every paper you write in my class will refer your every mistake you make to a specific page in that book. If you don't have the book, you're not going to know how to fix it." And so, boy, we wrote and we wrote and we wrote and we wrote, and she was a tremendous taskmaster. Mm-hmm. But the last 6 weeks, she says, "Well, that's it, we're done." And everybody's jaw hit the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And she, "You mean we're going to have 6 weeks off?" She says, "Yeah, we need to talk." So we talked about careers and dating and all kinds of stuff.
Huh.
She is a tremendous person. Mm-hmm. People really avoided her, and she was a tremendous teacher, had a great influence on me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I enjoyed that class, and I enjoyed physics class, and That was taught by Bill Forrester's father, who was an affunciato of the Air National Guard. And so if you didn't want to do the classwork, you'd do, mention the National Guard, and he would be off and running, and we could talk about the National Guard for an entire period and avoid that day's work. But he got it all in anyway.
Mm-hmm.
He knew what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, was Mrs. Miles, is that correct? Mrs. Miles, the English teacher?
Miles, M-I-L-E-S.
Was she an influence on your decision to become a teacher in college?
Some, yeah.
Okay.
She and Mr. Williams, who was the debate teacher.
Okay.
He also had a large effect. Those three sergeants, Army sergeants, had a big effect. The speech teacher had a big effect. His was the most popular course in school. And
speech.
Yes. He directed all the plays ever. You had to have an interview before you could get in his class. And I was obviously impressive because I got to take it as a junior because he normally reserved all the slots for seniors. And you interviewed as a junior to get selected as a senior. And he said, and I told him I wanted to take it that year. And he said, okay, that's why I went to. That's what I was doing when I missed the English teachers.
Mm-hmm.
My only regret about high school is I didn't take Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. That was a big mistake. But on the other hand, I took it out in college after I got out of the military.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it even better because I had a real expert teaching it.
Mm-hmm.
And Shakespeare in the Park was just getting started in Fort Worth. So that was one of the things we did because it was free. I became a real Shakespeare scholar for a while.
Wow.
And I wound up teaching English in high school instead of speech.
Okay.
And I taught for 16 years.
What drew you to Shakespeare? What was it that
just the
attracted you?
The stories, mm-hmm. His insight into human nature,
mm-hmm.
and the human condition. You can continually relate that to yourself. You know, Julius Caesar is the second most quoted piece of literature ever written next to the Bible. So that gives you an idea about how people think about him.
Yes, sir.
And that's not my favorite play, by the way.
It's not. What is?
Taming of the Shrew.
Why is that your favorite?
What?
Why is that your favorite?
Well, because it is totally misunderstood by most audiences.
Okay.
They think it's a male chauvinist put down of women, and it's not that at all. It she wins every battle, even though it appears that he does.
Mm-hmm.
But she actually wins every battle, and she does it the way women have done it for centuries. She just. But she needed to temper her temper,
mm-hmm.
and that worked out for the best for both of them, and I thought that was a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just enjoy the play.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Elizabeth Taylor and Robert and what's his name?
Was that Richard Burton?
Richard Burton made an excellent movie, and that's why they've never really made it since then. Because they did an excellent job,
mm-hmm.
and that I used that in my classes,
mm-hmm.
and the kids just loved it. They just ate it up.
Mm-hmm.
I also taught Julius Caesar, and they didn't necessarily eat that.
Mm-hmm. They didn't.
No.
Okay.
Even though, well, one reason is because the movie's so lousy.
Mm-hmm.
I use a lot of videos,
mm-hmm.
because that way you can reach kids that don't read very well,
mm-hmm.
and between that and my lectures, even the kids who didn't read very well could get by, as long as they did a reasonable job of writing. So, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, one quick question about your experiences growing up during World War II. You mentioned participating in the drives.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could describe the effects of rationing on your family and community, yourself.
Oh, yeah. Mother complained about that all the time. And it affected me mostly because sugar was rationed. You didn't get any cakes and pies.
All right. What other rationing?
You couldn't buy candy bars either.
Yeah.
My friend of mine...
Chocolate.
His father owned a grocery store. Mm-hmm. And so I had an in. I knew every time he got a shipment of Hershey bars. So I was first in line the next morning with my nickel.
Okay.
And he kept them under the counter so that he could pass them out to his good customers.
Okay.
And, there were lots of little shenanigans like that that went on.
What did you think about... another World War II question. Were there very many Japanese Americans or German Americans that lived in your community?
There were no Japanese Americans, but there were German Americans. And in fact, the lady who cooked the lunches for the public school was a refugee from Germany. Mm-hmm. Her name was Schutger. And Gerhard Schutger is still a friend of mine. We have neighborhood reunions every year. And he and I wound up standing around. He and I and R.B. Denton wound up standing around because R.B. and he lived right next to each other, and R.B. was one of my best friends. And even though he was older than us, we sort of, you know, palled around together in the afternoons and stuff like that. Because I was always over at his house. And I was always over at somebody else's house. And unless we needed to play a game, then we used my house because I had a big side yard that we managed to beat down, and there was an outline of a baseball diamond and right in the big middle of it. Anyway, there was nothing like that that went on. And also there were German prison camps around the area. Nobody thought anything about them.
You mean German POWs that were brought and kept there?
Not in our area, but in around Texas.
Yes.
And I forget where the nearest one was. I went to it at one time. I don't remember now. But of course, everybody was patriotic. The troop trains went through our community and loaded down. They also the. In fact, the matter is, if you got stopped at a railroad crossing in the hot summertime, you just shut off the engine and got outside and fanned until the train went by, because it was a long time. The railroads really probably were the worst hurt industry in the war. They wore out the road beds, they wore out their equipment, and after the war the government didn't help them much. And that's why our train system is in such sorry shape today compared to the rest of the world.
As you indicated, you knew someone that was a train expert, and one of your uncles, I guess, was a train expert. One of your relatives was a train expert.
Oh yeah, he was a dispatcher for the Cotton Belt, and my grandfather was a station agent for the Cotton Belt, and my other grandfather was an engineer for the Cotton Belt.
Okay.
So I had a railroad background.
Yes, sir.
And
he went to Germany to help rebuild their system.
Right.
Where ours was, as you said, was abused and it was not built back up. So yeah,
that's the ironic part of it.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And he actually he worked and got a retirement from the railroad, but he actually became an insurance agent and made more money selling insurance than he did working for the railroad. But he did it to get the pension.
Okay.
Because you're an insurance agent, you're an independent businessman, and so that way he got his pension, got a pension and Social Security.
Okay. How important was radio in your family?
Oh yeah, radio was, that was it. We listened to the radio on a nightly basis, usually starting with the Lone Ranger at 6 o'clock and going through the First Nighter and Inner Sanctum and Lux Radio Theater, all of them. We listened to all of them. And I particularly listened to, when I was younger, to the ones in the afternoon, Tom Mix and Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, and Little Orphan Annie, and sending off for the Dakota rings and all that stuff.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. We did all that, all those things. Wow. And the first guy kid who showed up with a Dakota ring, boy, he had it over everybody else for a week or so, and everybody else got theirs. And you had to buy the right kind of cereal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated cereal.
Oh, did you?
My family had to eat it.
And, let's see. As you were growing up, did your parents discuss politics and the war and things like that with you at the dinner table and in
they,
conversation?
They did and they didn't. They were firm Roosevelt supporters, as most of the country was. And they were worried considerably about the war all the way through, because they were fearful that my dad would have to go. And my mother was particularly fearful that it would go on so long that I would have to go. Mm-hmm. And because of my cousin's experience with the three landings in the Pacific, she was really, that was a real fear.
Yes, sir.
And, but they didn't really discuss it a whole lot. My dad read the paper every day. And that's what he would do. He'd come home and we'd have dinner, and he'd go in and sit with a paper in front of him all evening, reading the paper. And Sundays, he spent laying on the couch reading the paper. And I remember one time he was extremely angry with my mother because she voted different from him and canceled out his vote. So they were really voters, and they were kept up with the issues, and they went their own ways, pretty much. And they had, hung the blue star on a window for relatives that were in the service.
Mm-hmm.
And we contributed scrap aluminum. My dad sold his car. We didn't have a car through the whole war because the tires wore out and he couldn't get tires. So rather than put it up on blocks, he sold it. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't have a car till 1947. It was before that. It was 1946. We bought a 1939 Chevrolet from my uncle, who used it as a work car and paid $50 for it.
Oh, wow.
So you can imagine the condition it was in. And then in 1947, he bought a 1946 Ford. And that was our two cars for while I was in college. And he didn't buy another one until 1954. He bought another Ford. And let's see, politics. I don't remember them discussing it, but of course all of us kids went to all the war movies.
Mm-hmm.
We saw them all. In fact, I had my first job, I said 14, I actually had a job at 13.
Mm-hmm.
I was the assistant janitor at the theater. I was responsible for cleaning the lobby once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, I got to see all the movies I could see and eat all the popcorn I could eat. Didn't get any money.
Uh-huh.
But I took it full advantage, you can imagine.
Yes, sir.
So I saw every movie that came, usually twice.
Okay. Did you have any favorite war movies? Did you have any favorite war movies?
Oh, I liked them all. No, I really didn't. I determined from them that I didn't want to be on a boat.
Okay.
Because I was not much of a swimmer, and even though I swam all my life, I didn't want to drown. And like I say, ROTC convinced me that slogging through the mud was not the way to live. So what did that leave? That left the Air Force, who lived on their bases, not necessarily comfortably, but they could go to London and chase girls and stuff like that.
Okay. What do you remember about Roosevelt's death?
Okay, I remember we listened to all of his speeches, and the day he died, the city of Dallas, all radio stations did not publish, did not play any other normal programming. They played President Roosevelt's favorite music all day long. Yeah. And then they would break in with news bulletins about the war and what was going on in Washington and that sort of stuff. And so that was a very, very big day and a very emotional moment for the country, because nobody really knew Harry Truman, and nobody really knew how the war was going to turn out mm-hmm. at that time. Mm-hmm. And there was considerable concern about that. And everybody was happy when he dropped the bomb.
Yeah.
And it was all over. And you know, ironically, almost the same thing happened in Vietnam. When Nixon sent the B-52s in, all of a sudden the war was over. And if they'd done that right after Tet, the war would have really been over. And they could have done it without any problem. A lot of lives would have been saved. But we don't learn much from history, unfortunately.
Yes, sir.
And it's going, the same thing's going on right now, went on at the beginning of World War II. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, Saddam Hussein is Hitler's twin. He's a despotic, cruel ruler who rules by terror, has murdered his own people, mm-hmm. has buffaloed the rest of the world mm-hmm. with his golden tongue, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And he's a real bad actor, and we need to get rid of him. And, of course, so is Kim Il-Jung, too. He's no panty waste either. So.
Well, speaking of Roosevelt's speeches, did your family listen to his fireside chats?
Oh, yeah. Well, anytime he was going to speak, the radio was on, and we heard it.
Yeah.
You know? Because the perception was he always told you the truth. Even though he really just sugarcoated a lot of it and avoided saying the harsh things. He kept everybody focused and in support of the war and the war effort. And of course, a big part of the news was breaking records on the home front, you know, mm-hmm. producing all those airplanes and guns and tanks and mm-hmm. winning the Big E mm-hmm. for excellence mm-hmm. because of meeting your goals for production mm-hmm. and so forth. That was really what pulled us out of the depression. Everybody got working, and the factories were rebuilt and modernized, and it just generated the boom that went on and on and on after the war. Mm-hmm. And probably the greatest run of prosperity we ever had, despite what Clinton's government told us. He was the biggest liar I've ever heard.
Yes, sir. Well, why don't we talk about college? You mentioned already that you did try out for football, but you decided not to play. What other recreational, non-curricular activities did you?
We went to all the athletic events.
Okay.
And we would go down to the downtown and go to the movie, mm-hmm. even though they showed movies in the Student Union building. They showed them once a month, and they were old movies. So if you wanted to see the latest movie, you went downtown, you paid 35 cents mm-hmm. to go to the upscale theater. Mm-hmm. And on Friday and Saturday, you could go across the street to the Bucket of Blood, which showed Western, double feature Westerns every Friday and Saturday,
okay.
Friday night and Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually the Lyric Theater was the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
But to us, it was the Bucket of Blood.
Because of the violence of the movies, or
no, they were just cowboy movies,
right.
Just a typical fare of those days. You know,
mm-hmm.
John Wayne would ride down and pull the other guy off his horse and punch his lights out and mm-hmm. tell the girl goodbye and ride off into the sunset.
Right. Why the Bucket of Blood?
Well, because there was a lot of shooting and
okay.
bad guys
okay.
getting
That's
shot and stuff
okay.
like that.
Okay.
And there were a lot of Custer movies made back in those days too.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they were all bloody.
Mm-hmm.
And, I guess I must have seen Custer get massacred at least 15 times. Anyway, naturally there were dances and dating and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
But I wound up dating mostly girls back in Dallas. That one of them would lived in my neighborhood for, you know, the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one my mother introduced me to, ironically enough. And I went with her pretty much all the way through college. And we broke up when I went in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. We broke up. I also had another girlfriend. The girl that I told you about that I'd known all my life and was dating, we broke up and she introduced me to her best friend, and I dated her best friend for several years, too. So I wasn't the steady, I didn't go steady with anybody. I dated a lot of different groups. And we'd do things like go to a movie and get a hamburger afterwards. If you had a really big night, you went to Sammy's restaurant. And you went to Sammy's because Sammy treated teenagers like they were just like adults. And it was a very upscale restaurant. So if you took a girl to Sammy's, you really were spending some dough. You must have spent all of at least $3 for something to eat. And
for both of you?
Yeah.
For both of
yeah.
you, total of $3.
Oh, yeah. Even though you went to Sammy's, you probably got a hamburger anyway. Or a tuna fish sandwich or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever was cheap.
Well, what do you remember about Cold War events as that was unfolding in the aftermath of the Second World War?
Okay. The Cold War was one of the more serious wars we ever fought.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not getting the recognition it deserves. We spent billions of dollars on it, and it went over a long period of time, and a lot of people devoted their entire careers to it, and I particularly feel it because I was an interceptor pilot, and we were the first one to win our war part of it, because the Russians quit building bombers and started building missiles, not because they knew they could not get through our interceptor shield. When we built the F-102 was when Hitler and when Khrushchev said, we're not going to build bombers anymore, we're going to build missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody believed them. And so consequently, we kept building interceptors. That's why we got the F-106. And then we found out during the missile crisis, the Cuban Missile Crisis, that they really were building missiles, they're not bombers. And that was the death knell for the interceptor business. And I was a part of it. I was in Alaska when that happened, and that was my first real introduction to war footing. Because what happened was, is they called us on the phone, went through our telephone tree, and to report to the squadron immediately, ready to fly. And this was very unusual because normally, you know, there's a little grapevine around. We know there's going to be an exercise. And it was not only that it was not at night, which was when most of our exercises were, but it was during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was called whether you were off or not. Normally, if they'd have an exercise, unless they absolutely had to have you, they would leave you off because you spent so much time away from home. They called us back in, and we knew it was serious when there was a colonel up there to brief us. And he briefed us on that the Russians had been detected bringing intermediate missiles into Cuba, and that the DEFCON had been moved up to that just below full war, and that we were going to deploy. We were to go home, pack our bag for at least a week, tell our families to check the emergency supplies, the sea rations, the water and the blankets in the basement,
mm-hmm.
and to pack bags and be ready to evacuate. And they were either going to evacuate by car to Seward, Alaska, or by train. And they would be told which they were going to do, to keep the gas tank full And of course, everybody started went, ho, 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 what are they going to do? Go to Washington? That's a target. Mm-hmm. Seattle's a target. Mm-hmm. They were not going to fly them out, though. They were going to go out by ship. And so that told us that all the flying assets were committed. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, we went home, packed bags, and brought back. And then we got the briefing, and our squadron commander gave us a briefing. And we had the largest squadron in the world at that time. We had 60 pilots and 44 airplanes. We actually had a wing, is what we had under one squadron. And eventually, we also had T-33s and B-57s in the squadron as well. And we pulled alert at four places: Elmendorf, which was at Anchorage; Allison, which was just outside of Fairbanks; Galena, which was at Galena on the Yukon River, which was living in a junkyard, literally; and King Salmon, which was on the King Salmon River, which was great because of all the fishing. And by the way, I'm probably the only man that was ever up there that never caught a fish. That's another story. Anyway, Colonel Rogers told us that we would be deploying, and it would be up to the flight leads to give the final briefing, but that he personally was going to see to it that we did it under complete radio silence. Mm-hmm. We would take off with a green light from the tower, and then we would fly over the field when we got there and circle around for landing and get a green light to land. Mm-hmm. There would be absolutely no radio transmissions, not even an emergency. If you have an emergency, just bail out. Turn on your beeper and forget about it. They'll come get you. And he said, I don't know what the other flight leads are going to do, but we're going in tactical formation at 300 feet and 400 knots. And boy, our eyes got big because the manual was not below 1,500 feet except in emergency for takeoff and landing. So anyway, we didn't even know what tactical formation was, so he had to draw it on the board. It was a fingertip formation. Mm-hmm. Where you were about a half mile apart. And, so anyway, he said, then we'll join up just before we get there, and then we'll go in over the field in formation, and we'll peel off just normal for a pitch out, except we'll go all the way to the end of the runway. We won't make one of those fighter pilot landings. We're going to be safe. And so we had 8 airplanes, 24 airplanes on alert at the sites, and we had 8 airplanes on at Alaska, so that was 32, and the rest of them were on alert from the field, living in the squadron building. They set up bunks in there, in the briefing room. So anyway, every airplane was on alert, and we sat that way for 3 days, glued to the radio, and listening to what was going on. And then when it was over, naturally, I was the unlucky one, because, see, that was my week off. So I went to Galena, which is where I was supposed to pull alert the next week, so I just stayed there 2 weeks. And after it was over. Mm-hmm. So that was really a big deal. Mm-hmm. And we were really prepared to go to war. Mm-hmm. No question about it. And our families, of course, were sitting at home worried about us because there was no communication back and forth. Right. Normally, we could call home. But it went through radio relays, so they didn't want anybody to know how many airplanes we had on alert or where they were.
Well, in terms of the earlier Cold War events that happened, for instance, while you were still in high school and then when you were in college, what do you remember from the 1945 to 1949 period?
The main thing was the Berlin airlift. Mm-hmm. We didn't have much of a defense. We had taken all of our airplanes and scrapped them or sold them or given them to other countries. We had a very, very weak, small air force. And they were also going to all jet. And they were spending enormous amounts of money buying jets. Now, initially, they got the tactical fighters. They got the F-80 and the F-86. But the interceptors were initially P-47s and P-51s. Then they got the F-89, the F-94, and the F-86D and L model, then the F-102, and then the F-106 after that, and the F-101 also. So when they built the Century Series airplanes, which were the best we had ever built up until that time, they built the F-100 as a tactical fighter, the F-101 as an interceptor, the F-102 as an interceptor, the F-104 as an interceptor, although it also had a tactical version, and then the F-105 was a nuclear tactical bomber, and the F-106 was a interceptor, and the F-111 was a nuclear tactical bomber. So you can see where the emphasis was, just from that. And so the actual tactical bomber people were still flying the F-100, and it was the lead tactical fighter and the lead bomber. Tactical bomber, except for the F-105 and the F-111, it was the close air support airplane at that time. So they really didn't get very much. And the F-105 and the F-111 was the first one that had any radar in it. Well, the F-4 did, but it was a terrible radar. It was strictly a day fighter. It didn't have any range. Lockheed did the greatest sell job in the world to sell that airplane. And they sold it all over the world. Everybody thought it was super, but it was a terrible airplane. The guys that flew it liked it. And they built the bombers, B-52s and the B-47s. And I was associated with both of them in the Air Police.
Okay. But when you... When you were still in high school, how concerned was your family about the Cold War as it emerged in 1946, 47, 48?
There was always an underlying distrust of the Russians.
Okay.
That the idea was that they would go their own way and that you couldn't trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And primarily because of Stalin's pact with Hitler.
Yeah.
And that was strictly a marriage of convenience as far as everybody was concerned, and after the war, they showed their true colors, as the way everybody felt about it. And we had to do this, or otherwise we'd be gobbled up, just like they gobbled up a lot of Europe, and tried to gobble up China, even.
Mm-hmm.
And even though China was a communist country, they still attempted to gobble it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a. Their theory was world domination, and everybody believed that that was the way, that was really the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And that the nuclear war was something that could happen, and if it did, it just did.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing we could do about it, but we were going to do our best to make certain that there was, if there ever was one, that there would be no question about it after it was over, that we were going to be the last man standing.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we were sick or not,
yeah.
And which was a very good possibility.
Yeah.
On the Beach was a very big movie,
yes, sir.
Because of that.
Yes, sir.
And there was also a book called The Last Babylon,
mm-hmm.
which was another big hit. It was never made into a movie, but it was a big... all us high school kids read it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
1984 was also a big book.
Mm-hmm. Well, 1984 brings up...
Brave New World was also a big
mm-hmm.
one.
How did your community respond, did your family and your community respond, to McCarthyism?
To what?
To McCarthyism and that rampant anti-communism.
Everybody thought he was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was nothing but showing off to bring him a political advantage.
Mm-hmm.
This was when our distrust of the Congress really began, because nobody seemed to be able to control that idiot.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as there was a real concern about communism infiltrating mm-hmm. our institutions. The biggest hit show on television was I Was a Communist for the FBI. Mm-hmm. And that every week he infiltrated some other communist cell that was infiltrating one of our government office. So it was a real fear, mm-hmm. but nobody, the real concern was nuclear war. Mm-hmm. And that if we could prevent that, we would eventually prevail, and which is exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. And we spent an untold billions on it, and people devoted their entire careers to it, mm-hmm. and we won, and it made it worthwhile. Now, unfortunately, we did that. Now we're the bad guy, mm-hmm. because everybody hates the heavyweights, mm-hmm. or because they want to be heavyweights themselves.
Mm-hmm. How did your community respond to the execution of the Rosenbergs?
They figured they deserved it.
Okay.
You know that the spread of nuclear weapons was something that we really need to prevent, mm-hmm. and we didn't do it. We didn't do it very well. And unfortunately, you talk about the Rosenbergs, that really wasn't what let the cat out of the bag. The cat out of the bag was scientists sharing the information with each other, mm-hmm. and the misguided idea that the more people who had it, the less likely it was to be used, mm-hmm. which could totally ignore Hitler, totally ignored Saddam Hussein, totally ignored Kim Il-Jong, and they're all people like them, mm-hmm. who really don't really care mm-hmm. whether they live or die, as long as they can hold on to power. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's the way it spread around the world, was scientist to scientist, mm-hmm. not the Rosenbergs. Mm-hmm. They were sort of a show trial. And the only reason it was such a big deal was the death penalty was still being argued mm-hmm. back and forth. Mm-hmm. And but they were not the only ones. Chamberlain and Oppenheimer, mm-hmm. and there were several of them, all at about the same time. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of people were saying it was a witch hunt and all that sort of stuff, but. I guess the real thing is nobody really knew, but everybody was really afraid that the Russians would get a leg up and we would wind up losing.
Sure. And,
so that was sort of tolerated.
I have a weird follow-up question about some of your childhood play activities. You mentioned that as kids you used to play together, play war.
Yeah,
and of course you'd split up Americans versus the Japanese versus the Germans.
No, they were always imaginary.
Oh, they were okay. They the enemy were, was an
that's
imaginary.
Right. That's right.
Okay.
When I said we fought World War II, it wasn't World War II. Mm. It was the North against the South.
All right. Okay.
It was a civil war.
Right. Right.
Although black had nothing to do with it. It was just the dividing line between the two.
Right, the sports.
Yeah.
We fought the civil war in sports.
They went through in
but
sports.
But when you were playing war as a kid, did anybody ever play our allies, your friends? Would anybody be the British or the Russians or anything like that? Okay.
No.
Right.
We were always John Wayne what was it? John Garfield was another one. Gary Cooper.
Yeah. Okay.
Whoever was the movie star. That was of the week. That was who we were.
Okay. All right. Well, we've been talking for an hour. Let's take a quick break.
Okay.
Okay, we're back from break. I was wondering if you would, what you remember about the Korean War and how that affected your college experience and the atmosphere at the university, at the college, about the war and how it was.
Well, the college experience was that everybody wanted to get an ROTC mm-hmm. so they wouldn't have to go to war.
Okay.
And the perception of it was that it was an extremely hard, dirty war that we started from way, way, way back. Mm-hmm. And we just almost got thrown off. And if it hadn't have been for the brilliance of General MacArthur, we would probably have been pushed completely off the peninsula. Um, there was a very little, it was hard to understand why Eisenhower
This is Steve Maxer continuing the interview with Mr. Ray Janes on the 8th of March at approximately 12 o'clock noon in Lubbock, Texas. This is CD number, mini disc number 4. Just a few more quick questions. Well, you were at the Pentagon. Of course, the war came to an end for the United States. That is, the Paris Peace Accords were signed. The Paris Peace Accords were signed in 1973, in January, and that effectively ended American involvement. What was going on in the Pentagon when that happened?
Vietnamization.
Well, yeah, right. We've gone through Vietnamization, turned the war
over.
We were
heavily involved in that. We supplied all kinds of helicopters to them, and all of our A-1 assets were turned over to them.
Okay.
They got additional F-5s. Mm-hmm. And the Army did all kinds of stuff as well. Mm-hmm. The whole Pentagon was involved in the Vietnamization. Mm-hmm. This was direct from Nixon, that we were to supply the Vietnamese with anything they might possibly need to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. And we did, and there was a sort of half-jokingly bets going along about how long it would last, because nobody really felt like the South Vietnamese were equipped or trained to defend themselves. That, not that they couldn't fight hard, not that they weren't good fighters, it's just that they were ill-led and ill-trained. And North Vietnamese were not ill-led and not ill-trained. And plus, they had more people. Just sheer bulk. And that's just exactly the way it turned out. And I used to go to the briefings. After they briefed the chief of staff, the rest of the air staff could get the daily briefing by just going down and sitting down on it. And I used to go down and sit down on it almost every morning. And it didn't sound good at all. The reports were coming back that these airplanes were sitting down there because they didn't have pilots to fly them. They didn't have crews to maintain them. And they didn't have crews to man the tanks, and you know, it was obvious that things were going to go bad shortly. Yeah. And I retired in 75, and I believe they failed in 75.
Yes, so, April of 75. When did you retire?
August of 75.
So just after the Saigon fell is when you retired. What was the atmosphere like at the Pentagon when that happened? When Saigon fell in April?
It was a, you know, foregone conclusion.
Okay. Not a lot of
We
surprise.
Were all trying to prevent cuts in the services there were a lot of talk about us becoming a hollow force already at that time. That we were not going to be able to maintain readiness. We're not going to be able to maintain the numbers of airplanes, the number of crews. That we had before, and the all-volunteer force was a big deal. That was being, you know, going around and around, and it became politically correct to say the all-volunteer force is the future of the service. And in other words, we're just moving on to other things. The air defense business was, I transferred the first squadron of F-106s to the Air Guard, and there was a big fight about that because ADC wanted to give them the round gauges. When the airplanes were built, the first three squadrons, and I was in one of the first three squadrons to get the F-106. You got the old-fashioned round gauges, whereas the later models had the tapes. The new instruments, vastly superior. And I was eventually able to sell it over great fighting by the fact that they had round gauge instruments, and that was less of a transition for the pilots to this superior performance airplane and easier on maintenance. And once they had experienced pilots flying the airplane, they and could handle the fire control system, and they had maintenance people who could handle the airplane, then they could get the taped airplanes, and there would be absolutely no problem with that.
Yeah.
And I remember her PR, this three-star general, who eventually became vice chief of staff. Mm-hmm. I think I had a hand in that, too. He called me in and he says, "Now, you really think these gauges make that much difference?" I said, "Sir, I've flown both types." He says, "Yeah, that's right. You've flown both types, right?" I says, "But, you know, I've flown tapes, too. I know what they're like." And I said, "Sir, it does. Flying it is not the problem. It's taking care of it that's the problem. It's transitioning not only in instruments, but with the fire control system as well." Mm-hmm. I said, "Okay, I'll fight it." Now, the reason why I think that I had a hand in him making vice chief of staff mm-hmm. was that we were the director of programs, and every year he had to go to before Congress mm-hmm. and brief Congress, specifically the Armed Forces Committee and the Finance Committee and all that, all the numbers of airplanes we needed and so forth. And prior to that, we worked day and night, 24 hours a day for about a week, preparing his briefing book, mm-hmm. which showed every airplane in the Air Force where it was and projected those airplanes out in that particular unit for the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it had to be absolutely positively correct, because he was not going to sit there and be embarrassed by some congressman having some information that he didn't have. So we worked night and day, and what we'd do is we'd work all day and into the night, and then take our stuff down to the computer room, have it put on the computer, get the runoff early in the morning, and go get back with the green eye shade to make sure that every dot was dotted and every zero was in the right place mm-hmm. and so forth. And eventually then that would all be typed up in a nice neat notebook that he could just flip through and answer any question about numbers of airplanes and where they were, right, just like that. Mm-hmm. And I got to thinking about all those hours that we spent doing that, and the Air Force had spent these millions of dollars on computers, and computers do nothing but crunch numbers. And these were nothing but numbers. There was absolutely no reason why these numbers couldn't come out of the computer. Mm-hmm. We put them into the computer. Mm-hmm. Why did we have to continually be checking them? Why didn't we continually put them in the computer, and when the time came, we just punched a button and it printed out the book? And so I proposed that to the boss. He said, "Oh, you'll never sell it. But this is a computer guy, you'll go see." And so I went to see him. He said, "Oh, we don't have the computer time. We don't have the facilities. We can't do that." I said, "We're talking about numbers here. Computers crunch numbers. Is that not correct?" He said, "Yeah, that's what we do." I says, "Why can't you crunch these numbers? If you can't crunch these numbers, then what good are you?" Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden he could say, "Budget down." And he said, "We'll see what we can do." Mm-hmm. So he assigned one of his guys to the project, and we worked on it for a year. And we printed out the book. And I took it to the boss, and the boss looked at it and he said, "I want approval from this, from this, and this. And he had me getting approval from the janitor, and I didn't understand that. But anyway, I went around and I took that book around and I got approval from everybody. And I took it back, and many people said, "Why am I looking at this? I don't have anything to do with this. PR wants you to look at it." Okay. Just sign it off, we go. So anyway, I took it back, and he sent me to do some more people, even more outlandish. And I couldn't understand that. And so I went and got it, and I came back, and I said, "You think he's going to send me out again?" He says, "Yeah, he doesn't want to use it." I said, "What do you mean he doesn't want to use it? This is better. It's going to save thousands and thousands of man hours." He said, "Yeah. But then he's got to wear his glasses. He can't read it." It was in real tiny print, and it was a reproduction of a computer sheet, and it was not, in other words, the ink was not very dark. Mm-hmm. He says, "He's going to have to put on his glasses." He didn't want to do that. I said, "Oh, good Lord. Well, why didn't he just say so, and we'll just can the thing?" He said, "Because it is a good idea, and he hopes you'll get it to where it'll work." And I said, "Well, I complained about that myself, and they say right now this is it. There is equipment being required that will do a better job, mm-hmm. but right now this is the best they can do. Mm-hmm. And so we took it in there, and he looked at it, and he said, "You did it, didn't you?" I said, "Well, I've been trying, sir." He says, "Okay, you make sure I have my glasses with me. Slam them shut. Get out." And so he took it to Congress that year, and I think he really bowled them over, mm-hmm. and everybody wanted a copy of that book. Mm-hmm. And I think they started producing it, and I think that really gave him a name in yeah. front of all these people, and eventually wound up. He got the exact assignment he wanted, which was commander of PACAF, mm-hmm. promoted to 4 stars. He was out of PACAF, and then he was brought back as vice chief, spent 4 years as vice chief, and then retired.
Okay. Well, while you were there for those few years, I guess from 72 to 74, 75, is that correct, for 3 years?
I was there from 71 to 75.
71 to 75, 4 years. What kind of an effect did the Vietnam War have on Air Force acquisitions that you knew of? Anything?
Well, they were working on acquiring the F-15. Mm-hmm. They were working on one of the last projects I started was the KC-10 to replace some of the 135s that were, you know, really getting old. I also worked on the B-52 stress test, mm-hmm. which was stressing the flex of the B-52 wings to see if they could continue to in the inventory, mm-hmm. and was also chopping up the A models that were worn out at the Mazdak. That was probably the main job I did out there, going out there saying, "Yeah, these are hulks, chop them up," and watching the big blade cut the wings off of them, mm-hmm. so they could be melted down. And we were also doing that as part of the SALT talks. We were destroying so many weapons, and they were destroying so many weapons.
This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Lieutenant General Harold Moore. It is the 25th of October, the year 2000, approximately.
Talks, groups, and he was telling me about how they, we were saying we destroyed X number of B-52s. No, you destroyed this number. We know you destroyed this number. And he said,
This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Lieutenant General Harold Moore. Yeah. It is the 25th of October, the year 2000.
You really do need to get out there and count them and let us know how many you've destroyed and how many you're planning to destroy and so forth. And so on.
What about other new technologies in the works? Like, was there, at the time that you were there, was there any discussion about unmanned aerial vehicles?
No.
Or was that was in the future?
No.
Okay.
There were unmanned aerial vehicles, but there were drones that they were using to shoot down with the new missiles that they were designing, because the missiles didn't work very good in Vietnam.
Right.
And
were the drones controlled?
They were controlled from the ground.
Okay.
I have a friend of mine was at Tyndall, and he was in that little test skunk works that the ADC ran there for a while. Mm-hmm. And part of his job was testing the drone controls. And he has movies of the controller has a complete set of instruments, and he can fly the drone using his little sticks and throttles. Mm-hmm. That he has there and take the airplane off and if it was missed, bring it back and land it.
He could land it.
Yeah, he could land it. And fly an ILS. The only thing he could not do very well was round it out. He could not see the runway to judge when to round out. So he had to they put a radar altimeter in there, and that allowed them to determine when he had to round it out, and that's what really allowed him to land the airplane.
Did they have camera systems on it?
Yeah, they had a camera system.
So he could see the ground?
No, it wasn't the ground, it was radar.
No, okay, that's what I mean. The guy, the ground operator of the drone, he didn't have a screen that he could see what the camera was.
He could see the instruments on the airplane, but that's all he could see.
Okay.
He could see all the instruments, the engine instruments, and the altimeters, and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And he used that to fly the airplane. And so that's they'd been flying the Firebees a long time before that, but the Firebee was a very simple thing to fly. It was really sort of a cruise missile of its day.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys on the ground, they just flew them up to the altitude, and they had a little altimeter told them when they got there,
mm-hmm.
a little heading indicator told them what the heading, and mm-hmm. that's all they did. It wasn't really much, but the drone system evolved out of that.
Because that,
mm-hmm. they needed full-size drones
mm-hmm.
to not only test the missiles, but to test the fire control systems. They needed full-size drones that were fully maneuverable
mm-hmm.
to simulate enemy aircraft
mm-hmm.
because they quit shooting down T-33s flying straight and level with missiles doing that and being spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
But when the airplane turned, the missile missed.
Right.
And that's when they realized that they needed to do a better job. And
mm-hmm.
they started droning the F-100s, the F-102s, and the F-106s, now the F-4s,
mm-hmm.
Using full-scale aircraft as targets. And that's one reason that we've developed, you know, such superior missiles and fire control systems.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all started back then when I was in the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
It was all going on. Of course, I didn't have anything to do with that. The F-15 came in the inventory while I was there. We started the KC-10. The B-1 project started.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing I did was protect the first KC-135 from going into the boneyard.
Mm-hmm.
And that was General Ryan's personal airplane,
mm-hmm.
which was a KC-135, which was so modified with so many technical... It was actually a test bed,
mm-hmm.
is what it was. And they was very expensive to maintain, and because we were losing defense money, the defense contractors no longer wanted to maintain this all this specialized equipment that they were putting on that airplane. And so they were complaining about that. And so my successor came in, and I told him, I says, you need to gird your loins, because once that KC-135 goes in there, then other KC people are going to want to send other KC-135s, and we have no idea when we're going to be able to replace them. And you see, they have been replaced yet. Anyway, I went back and visited a couple of year or two later, and he said, "You were right."
Mm-hmm.
He says, "It was a big fight, and we lost, and it went in. And guess what? I'm getting all these people who want to retire these 135s. He said, "But fortunately, the KC-10 looks like it's going to work, going to fly."
Mm-hmm.
And it did fly, but it didn't replace them really.
Mm-hmm.
It just some of the airplanes that were just absolutely beyond repair were got rid of, but most of them were repaired and continued to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they did sort of a stress test on them, like they did for the B-52.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the KC-135R came to the inventory. That was the really revamped KC-135.
Mm-hmm.
And,
two more quick questions about the drones. That first drone you mentioned, that they get up to altitude and they fly, was that a recoverable drone, or
yes.
That was it?
Yes.
The first drone was even recoverable?
It was a Firebee drone, and we used it to... our yearly missile firings
mm-hmm.
For practice.
Mm-hmm.
We got to fire one missile mm-hmm. a year as an interceptor pilot.
Yeah.
And we always said, well, I shot another Cadillac today
because mm-hmm.
they cost about $5,000.
Yeah.
And so anyway, the big deal was to hit one of the drones, which was very difficult to do because they were very small and we didn't have a warhead.
Yeah.
So they had no proximity fuse, of course.
Right.
So anyway, that was a big deal to hit a drone. But they determined, then just before I left, we started flying air combat maneuvers.
Mm.
And on the last firing I went to, they maneuvered the target,
mm.
and our scores went down considerably.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, again, put them on the track that they needed a better drone,
mm-hmm.
they needed a better missile
mm-hmm.
Than what we had.
Mm-hmm.
And so all that technology started to evolve about that time.
Okay. And then the second drones, or the follow-on drones to that, were these just aircraft that were
modified
so that they could be removed?
They were aircraft pulled out of the boneyard.
Mm-hmm.
that the determination was made that there it was a higher priority to test the new missiles mm-hmm. than it was to keep them in storage.
Mm-hmm. What kind of aircraft?
First ones were F-100s.
Okay.
And then there were F-102s. Then F-106s.
Okay.
And they now F-4s. Up? Yeah. Mm-hmm. As airplanes retired mm-hmm. and were stored X number of years mm-hmm. and they needed new drones, then it was determined that these airplanes were never going to be used again for mm-hmm. an active mission. Mm-hmm. So it was a higher priority to test the new missiles. And that's still an evolving technology. What we're looking for is look and shoot, where you look and you see an enemy, you shoot, whether it's by sensor or visually, and you shoot and you forget.
Right, fire and forget.
That it takes over totally from then on, and you don't pay any attention to it. You're looking for another target.
Right.
And supposedly they can fire up to 6 missiles and can engage 6 targets at a time now. And surprisingly enough, mm-hmm. if you'll notice, the F-22 carries its armament internally mm-hmm. just like the F-102 and the F-106 did mm-hmm. years ago. That's why they wanted to do that. They wanted to carry it internally so they could get the speeds.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to do it so they can maintain the speeds. That's where they're getting their supersonic cruise
mm-hmm.
and naturally better maneuverability as well.
Right.
And
And I would imagine it also affects stealth capability.
Yes.
Because you get those that's external that. Armaments.
That was another thing.
Increase
that came,
your radar.
That was another unintended consequence in the F-106 and F-102.
Mm-hmm.
The F-106 and the F-102, because of the canopy design,
mm-hmm.
they tilted the seat back in the airplane so that you could pull sustain more G's
mm-hmm.
without a G-suit. Are almost as many G's without a G-suit as a guy with in a regular conventional seat
mm-hmm.
can sustain with a G-suit.
Mm-hmm.
And they really had no idea what was going on when they were getting into when they started doing unlike air-to-air.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they would bring another airplane to let the tactical fighters practice their air-to-air on
mm-hmm.
when they brought the 106 in, because they had determined, the Air Force Academy determined it was the closest to the MiG-21
mm-hmm.
profile
mm-hmm.
that of anything we had in the inventory. So they brought the 106 in, and the 106 had a field day.
Mm.
The F-4 just couldn't hack it without, you know, superior pilots and some finagling with the parameters
mm-hmm.
and so now you notice that most of them have this setback intakes and they have the squared off surfaces. They also found out that the 106 had a for some reason it didn't paint any bigger than a T-33 as a target.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, a lot of the stealth stuff came off of the 106
mm-hmm.
and particularly because of the way it was built.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the internal armament came off the 102 and 106.
Mm-hmm.
And seat design, that's why the F-16 seat is like this, and they do that, so they can sustain all those Gs.
Mm-hmm.
And that started with the seat and the F-106.
Mm-hmm.
And I got an example of that in Alaska. The F-100s used to come up there and deploy.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they strode in the big, tough fighter pilots. Oh, we're the real Air Force kind of thing. And so we had a field day. They were, when they first came up there, they thought it was great fun to bounce F-102s
mm-hmm.
who absolutely knew nothing about any air-to-air
mm-hmm.
until we started watching out for them and outmaneuvering them with ease and having a piece of their rear,
mm-hmm.
and in one case causing the F-100 pilot to have compressor stalls and think he was going to lose the airplane.
Whoa.
But that's where they found out the compressor stalls really don't harm anything on the engine. It's just a very uncomfortable situation to be in.
Mm-hmm.
But he was at low altitude and was very lucky in that he reached for the handles and let go of the stick and the airplane recovered,
mm-hmm.
and he realized it. And another story about that, about the F-106. The F-106 that's in the Air Force Museum
mm-hmm.
was from the 71st Squadron when I was in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it was selected was because the pilot bailed out of it, and the airplane landed itself and was restored and flew again. It's the only jet fighter that's ever crashed, landed itself, and been restored and flew again. And what happened was is that they were up there doing this air-to-air practice stuff with a brand new lieutenant, and he got himself in what we call a hoop-de-doo, which is an uncontrolled flight.
Mm-hmm.
And he was briefed by his leader to do these control movements to get out of it. And he did them, and nothing happened. And he did them again, and nothing happened. And they went past through 10,000 feet, and the Dash 1 says, eject, going through 10,000 feet, if you have not recovered the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So his instructor Paul said, eject, eject, eject. And the guy ejected. He came out of the airplane, was floating down, and it was making circles around him. And it landed in this farmer's field, the engine's still running, and they sat there and watched it till the engine quit, jacked it up on its gear, and put it on a truck, and trucked it off to the depot, and restored it, and brought it back to the unit. And what happened, they determined that he was so frightened that he was putting in the control pressures so rapidly that he wasn't allowing them to take effect. So they put a little thing in that says, warning, if you're an uncontrollable maneuver, follow the instructions and do nothing for 10 seconds.
Mm.
And if that doesn't work, release all control pressures and do nothing for 10 seconds. Because if he'd have done that, the airplane would
recover. It would have recovered itself.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And so...
Did you ever get into any kind of uncontrolled activity in your aircraft while you were flying?
No. I got in the office to haul them and shuttered them and all kinds of stuff like that, but I never really got into any uncontrolled.
Mm-hmm.
I was always very careful about that. We were starting to do things with the 106 that pilots had never done before. And particularly with a lieutenant right out of flying school,
mm-hmm.
you're very likely to put too much or too little in. There's a touch involved in flying airplanes, and that's what he got into.
Mm-hmm.
He got into something that too much rudder or too little rudder or something, or
mm-hmm.
whatever. Anyway, he got into it. We knew it was known that it could happen,
mm-hmm.
and that if you did these things, it would recover,
yeah.
but not as fast as he was doing.
Yeah.
Most pilots had the feel that got into that because they put the experienced pilots in first.
Yeah.
And that's when they found it, and that's when we were doing it.
What happened to that pilot?
Nothing.
Okay.
It was determined that, you know, he did what he was supposed to do, and the
right.
aircraft didn't recover.
Right.
Except
it recovered on its own.
It was an unknown condition.
Right. That's amazing, though. It just circled him all the way down to the ground.
Yeah.
That is
yeah.
unbelievable.
Talk about embarrassment.
Oh, yeah.
You're wondering how he ever lived that down.
Yeah.
He was known all over the Air Force.
Yeah.
And like I say, he's even in the Air Force Museum.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Well, a couple quick questions about the way the Vietnam War affected you and affected the United States. And in particular, what did you take away from your Vietnam War experiences that were most important to you?
The skepticism.
Mm.
I don't believe a lot of the stuff I read. I try to read through the flak,
mm-hmm.
the puffery
mm-hmm.
that goes on, and I get very irritated with people who take advantage of a situation like Kim L. Jong's doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
He's flexing his muscles because he knows he can.
Mm-hmm.
Saddam Hussein is pulling the same trick he's pulled for years.
Mm-hmm.
And these people who believe it because they don't want to believe the alternatives.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what went on. We had knee-jerk reactions.
Mm-hmm.
to everything in the media, jumped on the bandwagon, and if I had to label the Vietnam War, I would say it was a media war that was lost by the media.
Mm.
Just like the war the war in Cuba in 1898 was a media war that was won by the media.
Mm. Okay.
And we need to be, we have free speech in this country, but we need to make sure that it's balanced
mm-hmm.
free speech.
Yeah.
That's what has been wrong in recent times.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get a balanced view.
Mm-hmm.
I pick up we used to get a balanced view. I was a journalism student, mm-hmm. so I know that there used to be a balanced view. After all, we had the America Firsters in World War II, mm-hmm. and we had the German sympathizers in World War II, and they were allowed to have their views.
Right.
And when the fight came, they shut up. And that doesn't happen anymore. These people have, it's my way or the highway, and oftentimes they don't know what they're talking about. And if I had to talk to some of these protesters right now, I would say, are you prepared to take responsibility for the killing fields in Cambodia? Because people like you are directly responsible for that occurrence. And I think that would shut them up.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody in the media needs to say that. Because we were supporting the Cambodians when we were forced to pull out because of the kind of thing that's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
And what are we going to wait? We're going to wait till there's a mushroom cloud on New York City?
Yeah.
You know, we had plenty of warning in the first attack on the World Trade Center,
mm-hmm.
and we did nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're trying to finally do something. And we're getting all these people who were saying, oh, horrors! You're going to kill somebody! Well, some people need to die.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are, there are evil people in the world.
Yes,
and Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden are two prime examples.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Il-jung is a prime example. And as far as China making all this protest about peace, I would just get in China's face and I'd say, then don't you ever, ever threaten Taiwan again.
Mm-hmm.
But sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I say, mm-hmm. I have to admit that I enjoy seeing the editorial, you know, cartoons where France is holding their both hands up when they're voting. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And at least I think we're getting a better balanced thing, except on television.
Yeah.
Television does not balance it. In Dallas, there was protests going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You saw the crowd of about 100 people, maybe, that protested wanting peace. You saw two people that were protesting saying support our stance against Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And there were more people there than that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the bias that I see in the news media.
Mm-hmm.
And I just get tired of that happening.
Yeah.
And I get tired of people like that college professor who took that Air Force Academy cadet
mm-hmm.
and got his comeuppance about it. I get tired of that director of the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum wanting to portray the Enola Gay as a horrible occurrence
mm-hmm.
for the Japanese people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a horrible occurrence for the Japanese people. They have nobody to blame for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else that we as a nation should take away from our Vietnam War experience?
The best thing we can take away is if we're going to fight a war, let's fight it and win it. We do nothing else is acceptable. We fought in Korea. We didn't solve any problems there. We fought in Vietnam. We didn't solve any problems there. Where else? We fought in Iraq. We didn't solve any problems there. Halfway measures do not work. They do not solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're going to risk our lives, let's make it worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
Let's win.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't, if we're not going to do that, let's just throw the UN out. Tell them, we don't want you anymore. You're worthless anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
Let's pull all of our soldiers back from all over the world and say, we're building Fortress America.
Mm-hmm.
And if you mess with us, we're not going to take it. And if you get into trouble, don't come to us from help, because we're tired of putting up with the people who don't appreciate what we try to do for them.
Mm-hmm.
And forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
And just like Mexico right there. You know, Mexicans haven't fought a war in 100 years except each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying they're getting a say to whether Iraq should be or not a war or not. That's nonsense.
Mm.
That's nonsense.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No, I can't really think of anything.
Okay.
I think we pretty well covered it. I didn't have any idea that you'd be able to sit here and listen to me so long.
Oh, yes. Well, why don't I go ahead and put an official end on this. Thank you very much. This will end the interview with Lieutenant Colonel Ray James.